Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the show. Today, my guest is Senator Mike Braun, who joins me to talk stimulus, the fight for 15, and more. Senator, thanks for coming on.
Hey, my pleasure.
So let's talk about the giant stimulus bill that President Biden is about to sign into law. If you take out the $1.9 trillion price tag and split it up for every American, you get a number that's much smaller than the money that everyone will actually receive. Where's this all going?
Well, since I've been here, things are denominated in trillions, not hundreds of billions. And coming off the street, being a CFO and CEO of a company for 37 years, the reason I was both is because we were so little for so long. That meant taking out the trash and turning the lights on and off, all of that. But what I learned, being schooled in business, degree in economics, is that number one, you've got to have your overhead in check in any real world enterprise. Otherwise, the market takes you out, even if your revenues are cascading in. And here's a place, think about it, where the revenues have been cascading in. Since the Jobs Act and tax cut, that was the single best 2 years, and our company had gotten large at that time, where it's hard to maintain percentage growth because we hit the sweet spot on taxation, especially for Main Street enterprises. Won't get into that, but Ron Johnson had a lot to do with that because he knew the difference between the C-Corp rate and the flow-through rate, which most of us as smaller businesses would pay under. When it comes to $1.9 trillion, I've got to relate that to the size of my business that I built over nearly 40 years and divide that into that. And it gives you a real kind of view of perspective. We spend so much money here. And listen to this as well. 23% of it, we borrow every year routinely. All $4 trillion that we authorized, three of which we spent, trillion of which we haven't even spent or obligated. Now we add another two onto it. That's about 30% of our total economy size. It's crazy, but I got to give the other side of the aisle credit. Rahm Emanuel, don't let a crisis go to waste. Pile your agenda into it. There'll be enough sugar in it that everybody feels good. Even though the polling, they keep citing the one that says 72 or 4%, the ones I've read just, and it's not even signed yet, that'd be down a lot lower with maybe Republican support now that they know some of the gory details, would be much under that 60% level among Republicans. There's a lot of money. It doesn't make any difference here because most of my cohorts don't understand the macroeconomics, have never run a business, and this place reflects it. I mean, you couldn't see a place that is more dysfunctional than my new employer.
So one thing that interests me there is that these people who are pushing the stimulus bill keep talking about COVID, defeat COVID, American Rescue Plan. But according even to PolitiFact, which is a fact checker with a liberal bias, more than 90% of the spending in this is not related to COVID. Do you think people or your constituents or voters across the country who might be upset with Republican officials for voting no, do you think they know that this bill isn't actually that much to do with COVID?
Well, a pig in a poke is something that you can't see up front, but it becomes more evident every day after you have to stare at it. So when you look at pensions being bailed out, mostly in blue states, when you look at state governments, and the way they configured it, it wasn't based upon population. It was based upon population and how high your unemployment rate has been. Well, first beneficiary, California, $42 billion of the $350 billion. I think Illinois was right in there, and New Jersey, New York. Eight of the 10 states were blue states that had blanket shutdowns, no respect for keeping the economic patient healthy, did what government and bureaucrats do, get their point of view out there, have no respect for the productive economy, and then want government, all of us, to bail you out. And I think there are going to be enough ugly items in there. You can't get it out with 11 hours, Ron Johnson required to read it. Nobody was listening to it because I think a lot of that was overnight. And it was rammed through, no committee work, but we've got time. And I'll say this, my party is slow-footed compared to Democrats. They find that crisis, they run with it, they run their elections that way. We need to get a little better at playing their game. And a lot of that is not in just always reacting. It's in doing things a little bit preemptively. And we've got a lot to work on with what happened on the November election, what happened in the Georgia Senate races, that puts our party in a place. And they've handed us the silver platter, despite the fact it's euphoric now. I think it gives us the raw material to get the Senate back, win the House, and then see what happens in 2024.
Well, and that message of fiscal conservatism about the blowout spending and the waste and the corruption and the pet projects, that's a strong message. But how do you convince people that they should care about things like the national debt and government spending when for most people on Main Street, that's kind of slipped to the back of their mind these last few years? How do you convince them that it is important to worry about that right now?
And you're seeing that in our party, which has turned more populist, because I think that our new coalition is the working person. It is small business, entrepreneurs. The other side is aligned in a more elitist way with big business, now ironically partnering up with a lot of their agenda, especially on the cultural, items. So I think that when it comes to in the moment, it's hard for that person that knows it doesn't make sense, but that has not been getting any of the largesse to speak of that comes out of DC. A lot of that goes to big companies, goes to the healthcare industry that has got so much in statute and IRS code and things that make them immune to competition, transparency. You can't blame them for thinking that. But they also know this doesn't sound wholesome in the long run. And what I've been able to do and have tried to do is keep it understandable, make that argument that does not sound very interesting to listen to because it's got a lot of realism to it. But if we articulate it correctly into the 2022 election, use this when everybody understands the details, we can come out ahead. But it's got to be a different kind of Republican Party. Quicker on our feet. Pay attention to the people that support us. That's small business, entrepreneurs, Main Street, not Wall Street and big business. We'll be okay. We'll be okay.
That's one of the ironic things, the switch here between all of a sudden big business loves the Democrats. And one item that I found fascinating, it didn't make it into the final COVID bill because of Senate parliamentarian rules, but the $15 federal minimum wage. This was actually lobbied for by Amazon, because they know it would bankrupt small businesses. So how do you pitch, can you talk a little bit about how this would affect small businesses in your home state and how it's actually populist to oppose minimum wage hikes?
Because Amazon or Costco, that Bernie Sanders, chairman of the budget committee, with him at the helm of the budget committee, thank goodness we don't do budgets anymore, it's just a resolution. I said to myself, how sanctimonious for Costco to come in here and brag about $16 an hour wages or Amazon 15, when they should probably be doing a lot more. My wife's business in downtown Jasper pays all of her employees more than that. And of course they were shut down because they were non-essential businesses in the early part of COVID. So there is so much irony there. There's so much that makes you upset when you're from Main Street and big business. Amazon trying to run the market, doesn't pay any taxes. How did that happen? That had to be both Republicans and Democrats that have allowed that. There should be some minimum tax on big corporations. You do not have that ability as a Main Street business, a small business, a LLC, a sub S. You don't have lobbyists. You don't have a lawyer generally on staff. You've got to pay the tax rate that is generally your effective rate. The C Corp rate, which was 35 and then got lowered to 21, they had so many tax breaks, they actually were probably underneath 21% as an effective tax rate. I've got a unique position where I understand it, I think, better than any senator because I'm fresh off the pavement of having to survive in the trenches. Was in a sensible state government like Indiana, great business climate, lowest unemployment rate in the Midwest, handled COVID pretty well. We're back to full employment. The biggest thing about this last package is we don't want an unemployment benefit competing with getting people back to work. So yeah, there's a lot we need to do better as Republicans, because clearly we've got to revamp how we project ourselves, and it's got to involve bringing more young people, minorities in the party. I think it's still a center-right conversation that can be sold out there. It just can't be sold when you're trying to kowtow to big business and Main Street at the same time, or elitists from both coasts where most of the country is in between.
Well, one interesting thing too about the dynamic here is Indiana and New York City should not have the same minimum wage, right? All of Indiana or all of places like Puerto Rico. So I scratched my head at the idea that there should be any federal minimum wage rather than leaving it to states and localities. But some Republican senators, like Senator Tom Cotton and Senator Mitt Romney, they do want to increase the federal minimum wage, although not as much as the Democrats. Do you think that's a bad idea?
No, I'm not, if you make it smarter than just raising the wage. So if you do this correctly, you make sure it gets above the federal poverty level, which is somewhere $8.50 to $9. And you make sure that you don't push it then to the next level that would not take into the account that the cost of living in Indiana, Kentucky, Mississippi, and places that have great incomes. Income is pretty good in Indiana to boot. We're kind of like in that perfect spot. Regionalize a minimum wage if you're going to do it nationally, or make sure it doesn't push through the level where you'd start shedding jobs in lower cost states, and then raise it closer to 20 in New York City, San Francisco, and Seattle, where if you took the true cost of living, 15 is probably not a living wage there. So you got to be fair and acknowledge that difference. And you got to also acknowledge the difference between an entry-level wage, a training wage, and a full-time wage. If you took those two factors into consideration, you'd have a smarter federal minimum wage. The way taking it up to 15 would be typical one-size-fits-all bureaucratic approach that you get out of DC. That wouldn't work other than eliminating jobs. It would take the tipped wage method for restaurants, who I did a tour through Indiana 3 weeks ago. They love their job as servers. They make as much, if not more, than most union wages working part-time, and you'd be hitting the hardest sector in the whole COVID saga, restaurants. So you got to be smart about it, and you got to know a little bit about what's happening on the street.
So the biggest loser of 2020, unfortunately, very harshly treated, were small businesses. How does the GOP become the party of small business? What's the policies to emphasize? And how do they double down on that? Because it seems like small business has had a heck of a year and is only going to get worse with everything that's coming down the pipe in terms of the regulatory and tax hammer from the Biden administration. So what do you think the approach is for small business messaging and policy?
Number one, I'd listen to the National Federation of Independent Businesses, your local and state chambers of commerce. Chamber of Commerce US, like on healthcare, I thought surely the name Enterprise US Chamber of Commerce, they'd be for me to reform healthcare with transparency, competition, no barriers to entry, get the consumer engaged. They back the healthcare industry. So that gives you an idea of where they're coming from. So you need to pay attention to Main Street. You need to listen to any of the organizations that affiliate there. And if you do that, you're going to be talking to that worker that in many, many cases gets a decent wage already because they're treated like family within a small business, not a union corporate relationship, which generally ends up probably not being done for the same reasons my wife's business would want to pay a high wage. Keep people there that are good, you know them, and so forth. We got to get more used to that. Sadly, big business and the paradigm that might have worked 30 to 40 years ago that was maybe more conservative than what it is now, it's got to change. And if we don't adapt as a party, we're going to be on the curbside not only for missing who we need to pay attention to, but due to the fact that we're not good salesmen at bringing young people and minorities into our party, which I think you can explain to them how big government isn't going to be their salvation down the road, but we got to be more inviting and explain why it would work for them.
And is part of the equation here that it's young people look at the broken parts of our system today, and oftentimes they blame capitalism, but should they not be blaming crony capitalism and regulation and subsidies and these things that distort the system in favor of the elite? Do you think a populist free market message can bring in young people?
I think it will, because in time, they're going to, have families, get older, understand that the federal government is just a false promise, and the proof is in. That's the easiest case to make. Where I started off, borrowing 23% of what you spend, loading them up with debt. That sounds so abstract, but at some point, that $68,000 to $75,000 per capita unfunded liabilities, double that, compound that with bad behavior and shrugging off trillion and a half structural deficits in 6 to 7 years, they'll get the picture. So, but you got to explain it in the present if we're going to do anything about it. And a lot of that has to do with kind of maybe explaining it the way I try to, and point out how that cannot be good for you in the long run. And many, like in my hometown of Jasper, Indiana, probably the most entrepreneurial place per capita in the state of Indiana, we have young people moving back because there's opportunity. And I think they look more to their local governments and state government and are smart enough to know that it's a false promise out here in DC.
Do you think that COVID-19 plays into this and has shown people why you do need to care about individual liberty, what it's like when you have a crushing big government? Because one of my fears, and I'm curious what you think of this, is that the enormous invasions and expansions of government into the economy and our lives during COVID and emergency are here to stay.
And that's the part of a sugar high, or when you get the benefit in the moment. In building my business, I never tried to focus on that other than to pay the bills. I was always interested how you make it sustainable into the midterm and the long term. And if you do things like saving for a rainy day, living within your means, state government balanced budgets, knowing the difference between consumption and investment, things work out. In my business, 9/11 was the first challenge we had. We were still little, 15, 20 employees. We got over 1,000 now. 08, 09, we came out of it because we had a clean balance sheet. We did the things that I just mentioned. Opportunity came to us. Likewise, here again in COVID. And I think the lessons to learn from COVID is look at the policies that have come from the government approach. How did that work in New York? How's it worked in California? And in the meantime, you've trashed your economies. Maybe look at Florida, where Governor DeSantis has gotten lambasted for the fact that he was too daring. But he did what was most important, protected the most vulnerable. It was the most predisposed population in the country due to its age. And look how they've come out of it. On a per capita basis, I think they got better results than California or New York. That ought to be a lesson right there. On the other hand, I think that maybe there were some mistakes made by underestimating where COVID was going to go. I always took it seriously because I didn't know the nature of what it was going to be. But I think when we've come through it, you'll find out that the two things that were most impactful was cutting off traffic early, which Trump did from Europe and from China, and warp speed on vaccines. That 4, 5, 6 years, I remember they were arguing between the CDC and FDA, which bureaucracy was going to control it. That's having an entrepreneur or a business owner in charge. We'd still be stumbling around and we'd have vaccines 2 to 3 years down the road. Those are some of the lessons we learned.
Well, thank goodness for that, and that we have the vaccines coming down the pipeline. Senator, that's probably a good place to wrap up the serious policy talk. But just before I let you go, the fun part of the interview that I always do, Can you tell us what your most controversial food opinion is?
Well, it's a German recipe called chicken and glaze. And it's not controversial at all because it is so delectable. But to get the glaze portion of it, you've got to get a potato shredder and shred it as finely as you possibly can. And it takes about an hour to an hour and a half to prepare. And whenever I suggest it, I don't get many volunteers to grate the potatoes. So I guess that I love it so much, but it's tough to get anyone to make it.
Well, there you go. That's something I'll have to Google and try out. Senator, thanks so much for your time.
You're very welcome.